O life giving true joy, the light drives out our night. Our hope and restoration through its love puts an end to the devil's devilry. The passion takes away our sorrows, and instead of weeping, there is blessed good fortune in abundance. Songs, the words of a tune from medieval England, the singers, the Anonymous Four. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, a closer look at the great astronomer Galileo. Our conversation this afternoon will be illuminated by the letters of one of Galileo's daughters to her father. Our guest, writer Deva Sobel, has translated the letters of Galileo's oldest child, Virginia. Virginia, her sister and brother, were born to Galileo and Marina Gamba out of wedlock. For the two girls, this meant they were unmarriageable, and their father placed them in a cloistered convent. Virginia became Suor Maria Celeste, selecting the name to honor her father. The letters from Suor Maria Celeste offer new insights into the life of the astronomer. Among other things, they reveal Galileo as a man of faith, a good Catholic, and a devoted father. Deva Sobel writes about Galileo and his daughter in her new book, Galileo's Daughter, a historical memoir of science, faith, and love. Listeners, you can join us with your questions this afternoon. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. The numbers again, 333-WILL and 1-800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Deva Sobel is a former science reporter for the New York Times. She is also the author of the bestseller Longitude and co-author of The Illustrated Longitude. Deva, good afternoon. Welcome back to the Afternoon Magazine.
Hi there. It's a pleasure to be back. Thank you.
What led you to the letters of Galileo's daughter?
Actually, it was the research for Longitude, because I had to read about Galileo's efforts to solve the longitude problem. He was one of many, many people over centuries who had tackled that problem, unsuccessfully, I might add. But the book I read about his work in that area contained a piece of a letter from this daughter of his, and I was shocked by it because I didn't know he had a daughter, first of all. And then the fact that she was a nun immediately indicated that probably everything I had ever learned about his adversarial position with the church was wrong. And so I pursued the idea and found out that, in fact, she had written him more than 100 letters, probably thousands, but more than 100 of them survive to this day. And I wanted to really look at them and see what they said about him.
Mm. They're held in the National Central Library of Florence. And the letters that survive were written over a period of 11 years. When do they begin and end?
They begin in May of 1623, and they end, and I imagine they don't really begin there. They begin mm-hmm. earlier, but this is just the first of the ones that do survive. And then they end in December of 1633, and that was when Galileo was finally coming home from his trial in Rome and detention in Siena, and was finally allowed to come home. So she, her last letter is full of the joy of being on the verge of seeing him again.
Mm. She, it's clear from her letters she loved her father.
Yes, and he loved her too.
And she stood by him through his difficulties.
Yes, because I think both of them understood that he really never was an enemy of the church. It's quite clear from what she says that she believes entirely in his innocence, as did he.
Yeah. Now, she was living in a cloistered convent, so she was protected to a certain extent from the world. Did her views and her feelings about her father ever cause her any trouble in terms of the women that she was living with or with the church?
Apparently not. On the contrary, she often talks about how the others join her in her sorrow when she misses him or fears for his welfare, and how when she tells the others something good that's happened, such as his homecoming, how they run to her and embrace her with joy. There's no indication that she was in any kind of trouble at the convent because of his trial. And in fact, the convent as a whole was dependent on him. It was a terribly poor place, and it was poor by design because they were all committed to the ideal of poverty. But then they really did need food at times. They needed money. There was a time when they asked Galileo to make a plea for them with the Pope in Rome. And whatever they asked him to do, he did.
Hmm. Back to these letters for a moment, if we could. What do they look like, and what was it like to work with them?
Oh, it was a breathless thrill to see them. I actually began working with them in a fairly modern, typed-up version because they had been published in Italy as a book called Letters to Father, so that I was able to read them all and familiarize myself with the content before I actually traveled to Italy to see the originals firsthand. And I had to write for permission to be allowed to come and look at them. And they are on very fine old letter paper. One wonders if our modern paper would survive 400 years the way these letters have. But they're on a very fine paper, and they're all bound together as a book, along with letters he received from his mother, his sister, other women who wrote to him. It's curious how they're all together.
How is it that these letters have survived and been collected and are now in Florence?
They survived because he saved them, because they were important to him. And so he kept them with his important papers. And during the last years of his life, his last students made a great effort to collect his papers and to even get back letters that Galileo had written to his contemporary scientists so that there would be a complete record of his ideas. That was only partially successful. But all of this work was collected and then was published in a definitive edition at the beginning of this century. So the daughter's letters have been published, they've been available, but haven't been attended to. Maybe because she was a girl, and because they didn't talk much about science in their letters, so that they haven't been mined fully.
Some of these letters, some of Maria Celeste's letters, were translated into English at some point. When was that,
yes,
and what were the circumstances?
I believe they were all translated in the early 1870s by a woman who was writing a private life of Galileo. And, of course, these intimate letters from his daughter are a fabulous source of information on his illnesses and what he liked to eat and how often his work apron needed mending. It's all there. And so I believe she probably did translate them all, but she didn't publish the translations. She did publish excerpts from many of the letters in her book, which was called A Private Life of Galileo, based on the letters of his daughter. Mm. But the book is long out of print and is full of inaccuracies, so that it was discredited. And much of the really interesting material in the letters never made it into that book, and I don't know why.
Mm. And Galileo's correspondent to his daughter is missing, probably destroyed.
Probably destroyed, although no one knows for sure.
Mm.
Ever hopeful that it will turn up. And I was, in fact, accused by a friend of mine of having had the letters myself, but destroying them on the grounds that it made a better book without them.
That was a friend?
A friend with an odd sense of humor.
Yeah. Oh. Now, before reading these letters in Italian, before reading all of them, had you any idea of what they would reveal about Galileo, his life, his trials and tribulations?
No. And that made it quite a gamble at the outset. And so I sought advice from a couple of Galileo scholars whom I was sure had read them all. And I explained what I hoped to do, and I asked, what do you think of that idea? And the reaction was very positive, that the letters really were important, especially to students in history of science, and that if all I did was translate them and make them available, then that would be time well spent. And furthermore, that they would break my heart.
Hmm. What were you most surprised to learn from the letters?
How involved he was with her and how dependent on her love, her prayers, how beautiful their relationship was. Again, I, like most people, I tend to imagine Galileo as the marble bust. We don't really think of him in the fullness of life and having children and all of that entails. And so it rounded him. And the fact that my perception, that in fact the general perception of him as someone who had abandoned religion in favor of science, was completely erroneous. And in fact, the image of Galileo pursuing his science as a devout Catholic is much more interesting. And his whole struggle with the Church is far more interesting in its complexity than I ever imagined, from the simplistic pitching of the story as a case of science versus religion.
Yeah. How did we come to hold that view of Galileo and his battle with the Church?
I think it was engineered later. In the myth that has come down to us, because he has been mythologized in various ways, good and bad, and so the facts of the story fell away to the disadvantage of many people, I think, including the Catholic Church. I think this is why Pope John Paul II was so intent on re-examining Galileo's case and making a statement about it as recently as 1992. But as well-intentioned as that move was, I think it backfired on him, because I think the public reaction to it was one of scorn, and that, you know, how odd to bring up this trial again after so many centuries and pardon him. Of course, it wasn't really a pardon, but that's how it was seen again in the popular milieu.
Hmm. Galileo was a devoted father, at least quite devoted to Maria Celeste and his son. What were his feelings toward his other daughter?
It's hard to say. He said that he loved her, but she is a shadow figure in the story. She doesn't write, or if she does, the letters don't survive. So we hear only the older sister reporting on her because they were together in the same convent. And the picture that emerges of her is a very unhappy one. She seems to have been melancholy, perhaps alcoholic, and hypochondriacal. Things did not go well for her. It was a difficult life, and it's part of the strength of the older daughter's wonderful personality that she was able to live in those difficult circumstances and triumph in her spirit and be her father's support and be a mainstay at the convent where she fixed the clock and worked as the apothecary and taught the novices how to sing Gregorian chant, and she was really a phenomenal individual.
The two girls, Virginia and Livia, were placed in the convent because Galileo thought they would not be married because they were illegitimate. But then their brother, Vincenzo, is declared legitimate by fiat. Was that the way things were done?
Yeah, it seems that he was he and they were she. And there were lots of illustrious, illegitimate sons of the Medici. Even the popes sometimes had illegitimate sons who might inherit huge tracts of land and become quite wealthy. And women were different. They really, their choices were marriage or the convent. And there was not another way for them to go. And I was very mindful in writing this book not to view that situation in a modern sensibility, to explore it as it was and as it would have felt to them. Because there doesn't seem to be bitterness on Maria Celeste's behalf. There are times she distances herself from the other nuns because she must have occupied a special place there. She was clearly the most intelligent. She's constantly writing about being asked to compose letters for the Mother Abbess, clearly because she was the best writer. And so she is different from them, and yet she allies herself with them when she talks about we nuns or we religious. So she's made her peace with that life. She's not crying to get out, as many young women in those days did. There was something called a forced vocation, which meant that your family just deposited you there against your will. And there are many stories of suicide, madness. But she made it of a difficult situation.
Was Galileo devoted as well to his mistress, Marina Gamba, the mother of these three children?
Well, either way, they apparently tired of each other or had their reasons for not getting married. Galileo, as a scholar, would not really have been expected to marry. Scholars and physicians led a different sort of life, and yet no one would have expected him to be celibate either. He didn't attract any criticism for having fathered illegitimate children. And in fact, he took care of all of them for the rest of his life. And he also took care of his brother's children because his brother never seemed able to make a living. and his brother had 8 children. So there was a lot to look out for. The mistress was of a lower social standing than he had been born into. His family were considered, they were not wealthy, but they were well-born. And that was a very ancient, respected family with roots in the government of Florence. And whereas she had nothing like that in her background. And Venice and Tuscany were like foreign countries in those days. Italy was not a united country as it is today. And so he was maneuvering to return to Florence and to a court position there. And he probably wouldn't have wanted to have a Venetian wife at the Tuscan court. And then it's possible that she didn't want to marry him. She had a few documented clashes with his mother, who was a very difficult person. And maybe she wanted to keep his family at some distance from herself. Whatever the reasoning was, when he left Florence, he took the children with him, and she married someone else.
Now, being unmarried and not celibate, was that living within the laws of the Catholic Church at that time?
Well, as I said, there were popes who had illegitimate children, yeah. So a lot was overlooked that would not be overlooked today.
Yeah.
Or in another century.
Well, let's talk about Galileo and how he ran into trouble with the Church. I think we need to revisit some history, talk about that time when it was thought that the Earth was motionless and at the center of the universe and the Sun moved around the Earth. Then comes the Polish astronomer Copernicus, and this is the middle of the 16th century, and he proposed a system where the Earth turned on an axis and orbited the Sun. How was Copernicus's theory seen by the Church at that time in the mid-1550s?
It was seen, on the one hand, as a good mathematical argument to help astronomers calculate the date of Easter. That was a big astronomy challenge for the Church. And Copernicus proposed this idea in the line of that work. But he probably believed that it was also true in fact. And no one got too excited about Copernicus's book, for one thing because he wrote in Latin, and it was a very mathematical book. It wasn't something the average person would have read. And Copernicus died almost immediately after the book was published, so he never got to talk it up much. When Galileo came along, Galileo was born about 20 years after Copernicus died. And when he got interested in natural philosophy, he for sure learned of this idea. I mean, he did own a copy of Copernicus's book. Galileo's copy of Copernicus survived. And he was also very drawn to it because it explains some things about what astronomers observe in the heavens that are tough to explain if Earth is in the middle. And when Galileo began working with a telescope and discovering things like the phases of Venus, the fact that Venus actually goes from full to crescent, he realized that it wouldn't do that unless it were orbiting the Sun, not the Earth. And then he also discovered the moons of Jupiter, which showed that there were bodies out there orbiting bodies other than the Earth, which made it a more plausible argument. And he began to discuss this in public and to write about it in Italian so that the average person could understand it. And this got a lot of attention and a lot of angry attention, because the Bible, in a few places, seems to say that the earth is motionless and that the sun moves around it. But Galileo argued that the Bible was not supposed to teach you astronomy. The Bible was completely true, the Word of God, but it really dealt with the salvation of the soul. And if ever a statement in the Bible seemed to be in conflict with a truth discovered in science, then all it meant was that we had misunderstood the deep meaning of the Bible. And once we had come to a proper understanding of both the Bible and science, it would all be of a piece. The one could not contradict the other. But that approach, a very modern approach, in fact, the Church's current position on science and the Bible, but in Galileo's time, it was a dangerous approach because of the Protestant Reformation and because Martin Luther had said that each person could interpret the Bible in his own way, which the Catholics thought complete heresy. And so Galileo, as a Catholic, was really on dangerous ground once he started talking about how the Bible should be interpreted. And that's where he really attracted his dangerous enemies.
Mm. So was it Galileo, by talking about Copernicus and his system, that led to the Church's condemnation of that system?
Yes. It seems that it probably wouldn't have come up for condemnation if Galileo hadn't been shouting about it so much. I mean, he really was making it a topic of debate, a subject of discourses he was writing. He was really pounding for it, and so much so that many people thought the idea was his. They didn't realize that it was an idea that had come up in the previous century, and he was merely gathering evidence for it.
So then in 1616, what does the Church do with Galileo at that point?
They decide to really review the Copernican argument, and they decide that it is contrary to the faith and cannot be taught anymore. And so they looked at Copernicus's book, and they decided that if certain passages in the book were corrected to make the whole thing seem more hypothetical, then the book would be all right. But it was suspended until those corrections could be made. It was never banned outright. It was just suspended until corrections could be made. And there were a couple of other books that had come out which really did try to prove Copernicus and make it square with the Bible. And those books were banned. But at the time, nothing that Galileo had written was banned. He came out of that edict pretty free. The only thing was that he'd been told to stop talking and teaching about it. And so he did. He got extremely quiet. That's when he got really interested in longitudes. Did lots of other things. He read poetry. He wrote literary criticism. He developed a microscope. He was never at a loss for things to do. And it's one of the most interesting things for me in following his life was to see how often he was sick, completely incapacitated for weeks, months at a time, with illnesses, some kind of relapsing fever that he never shook his whole life. And yet he would carry on. You know, he would just have to take to his bed, but he would try to keep up correspondence and discussions, even when he was sick. Sometimes he couldn't do that. And then when he got well, he would pick up where he'd been and try to make progress. Mm-hmm. It's a remarkably brave way of life.
He challenged a lot of the conventional thought of the day. He challenged the thinking of Aristotle. How are those challenges met by people of the day and his peers?
Those challenges were actually the first vicious challenges he encountered. He had as many, if not more, enemies among fellow professors and scientists as he did in the church. In fact, he had churchmen friends who remained his friends all through the trial and afterwards. So it's, it's much more complex than science versus religion. But Galileo was very frustrated that his fellow philosophers were content to read the books of Aristotle and not to question anything Aristotle had said. And as though the universe would reveal itself only to Aristotle. And Galileo said, now we have new instruments. We're learning new things. If Aristotle himself could come back and see this, he would change his mind. But his followers are too blind and stubborn to look at the evidence. So he made those people very angry, and he embarrassed them publicly, which is a good way to make lifelong enemies. You know, when he got into one of these fights, he wasn't content just to take an opposing view. I mean, he would trounce the opponent so thoroughly and in such an embarrassing fashion that the person might never recover. I mean, he really didn't want to be on the opposite side in a debate.
Yeah.
So his one of the ideas, the cherished ideas of Aristotle, was that the heavens were perfect and that everything beyond, from the moon on out, was made of a different substance and was perfectly circular and shining and unchanging. Well, you know, Galileo looked at the moon through the telescope and said, guess what? It's got mountains and it's a big rocky body just like the Earth. There's nothing perfect about it. And those kinds of things made everybody crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the sun had these black spots on it. So that it was a completely new view of the universe.
Yeah.
And it was overturning millennia's worth of belief.
Yeah. We have a caller's daughter back into the conversation here this afternoon. It is clear from her letters that she was proud of her father and his place in the world.
Yes.
What do you suppose accounts for her comfort with this rather unconventional way of being in the world, Galileo's unconventional way of being in the world, looking at things from the point of view of what we think of now as a scientist, using the scientific method, always questioning?
I really don't think she would have had any trouble with that. I think because she would have shared his view, which was that there were several ways to God, that there was the Word of God in the Bible, and there was the work of God, and that one of the reasons that God had put humankind in the world with intelligence and manual dexterity and vision was to figure out the way the universe worked. Also to the greater glory of God, to appreciate the magnitude of his creation.
Hmm.
And Galileo was extremely talented in that regard. And I think she admired him for that and knew that he was a person of religious faith, and there really was not a conflict.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking today about Galileo with Deva Sobel, author of Galileo's Daughter, a historical memoir of science, faith, and love. My name is Celeste Quinn. You're welcome to call us this afternoon with your questions, comments. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Our first caller this afternoon is on line 4 in Eureka. Good afternoon.
good afternoon, an interesting conversation. You were talking several minutes ago about the influence of Luther, and I took it to mean his revelation that a person alone can understand the Bible, and you don't have to have the church to tell you how to interpret it. Do I understand you to mean correctly that had not Luther come along with this particular doctrine, that Galileo may not have been such a threat to the Catholic Church?
I think if the Catholic Church had not been facing the Protestant Reformation, they might not have been quite so nervous about what Galileo was saying. Yes, that is what I mean.
Thank you.
But that the Reformation threatened the church terribly and precipitated a council, the Council of Trent, where the bishops all got together and wondered how they were going to heal this rift between Protestants and Catholics. And one of the things that came out of the Council of Trent was a declaration of faith in which people promised that they would read the Bible the way the Holy Fathers of the Church said it should be interpreted. So Galileo, with his ideas, seemed to be going against that creed, and that put him in a bad light.
I guess there was actually a counter-reformation after that point, if my memory.
Absolutely.
And Galileo would be, what, about 60 or 70 years after Luther had died?
Well, Galileo was born in 1564.
I see.
And,
I have come to preeminence maybe around the beginning of the 1600s, he would have been.
When did Galileo come to preeminence?
Yes.
Yes, in the beginning of the 1600s. He became almost instantly world famous in 1610 because of the discoveries he made through the telescope. In fact, it's interesting to realize that in that time, when nothing traveled faster than a horse or a sailing ship, that his announcement of these new discoveries was immediately on its way to England, was read all over Europe, was even translated into Chinese.
Mm. You note in the book that there were some German scientists who, you can correct me if I'm not remembering this correctly, some German scientists who were thinking of converting to Catholicism but did not do so because of the church's view of the Copernican system?
Yes. There were stories told to the Pope about how the church's edict was hurting the image of Catholicism, of Italy, and of science in Italy all over the world, that because the church had taken this position, some scientists who saw the value of this position would prefer to stick with the Protestant faith where it wasn't such a problem.
Hmm.
And that was something that worried Galileo a great deal, mm-hmm. because he felt that eventually evidence would accumulate so that it could no longer be denied that the Copernican system was true. And he feared that the church would be horribly embarrassed. It had to go back on itself, which eventually did happen. And he wanted to avoid that situation. He wanted to say, look, let's agree that, and he had this wonderful expression, the Bible is a book about how to go to heaven, not how heaven goes. But he couldn't win that argument, and they insisted on issuing the edict that banned the teaching of Copernicus.
Mm.
And then much later, after his trial in 1633, when Galileo was condemned to house arrest, he was visited late in his life by John Milton, a great English poet who saw Galileo old and blind and a prisoner. And he wrote that the glory of Italian wit had been dampened by all that had happened to Galileo. So that was how the situation was perceived outside of Catholic Italy. And another interesting thing that came up is this business about the corrections made to Galileo's book. There's a science historian at Harvard, Owen Gingerich, who has gone around the world examining all the copies of Copernicus's book that survive. He's the one who described what Galileo's copy of Copernicus looked like. And he was very interested to see that outside of Italy, virtually no one bothered to make the changes in the book that had been mandated by the Church. In Italy, the copies were corrected, but outside of Italy, they weren't.
We're running out of time, I'm really sorry to say. And I think I want to get to an important question here before we're out of time. Galileo was on trial, 1633, and he is found by the Church to be wanting big time. He's sentenced to house arrest, but he publicly recants his view, doesn't he? Why do you think he did that?
I think he had no choice. He couldn't martyr himself because that would have made everything worse for him, certainly if he'd been tortured or killed, who would have taken care of the family, but also for the Church because he did not want to set himself up as an adversary of the Church. He would rather go along with it than be the instrument of the Church's embarrassment.
And Maria Celeste, she died before her father.
Yes, and that was the great tragedy of his life.
That really had a great impact on him. How did her death affect her father?
Oh, he was paralyzed for months by it, and very touching to read the condolence letters that come to him from his closest friends, who all knew how much he loved her. And there's one from the Archbishop of Siena that says that he has no words to console a father on the loss of such a daughter. Mm. So it's clear that not just from the letters, but from the reactions of other people, that everyone knew how close they had been.
Early in the interview, you talked about having your heart broken by these letters. And I think one of the very, very touching things about them is the little, they point out the little comforts that these two people gave one another. She mended his shirts. He made gifts of food and other items to make her life as a nun a little easier.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any particular story or any particular little comfort that you'd like to leave us with this afternoon that you would like to share with us?
Yes, it's one I found particularly touching. On the occasion of her brother's wedding, and her brother marries a girl who's been in a convent, but at 16, rather than take her vows, she comes out to get married. And Maria Celeste writes to her father how happy she is and how she wants to make all the pastries for the wedding to save him the expense. But she needs him to buy the expensive ingredients, and she sends him a little shopping list for the fine sugar and the almonds.
Mm. A remarkable story. Thank you for talking with us this afternoon, and thanks for writing the book.
Oh, it's my pleasure, I assure you.
Dava Sobel has been our guest this afternoon. She is the author of Galileo's Daughter, a historical memoir of science, faith, and love.